from the Los Angeles Times, this is The Envelope, the podcast, your ultimate guide to award season. I'm one of your hosts, Ivan Villarreal.
And I'm your other host, Mark Olson. Every week, our podcast showcases key voices across both TV and film.
Mark, this is my favorite day of the week. I just look forward to our conversations. How has it been going with you?
It's been a pretty good week. I mean, we'll see if you are looking forward to it quite as much, like once you're kind of out in the world a little bit more. I think it's just because it's like, who do you talk to, you know, lately? Not too many people. So just like, you're sort of, we're stuck together.
Well, I'm going to force you to an in-person lunch. That's what I'm going to do. You know, like today I spent like part of my lunch purging a box I found in a closet. And I found old screeners of like the Game of Thrones pilot and the Up All Night pilot, that Christina Applegate series on NBC that came out like, God, maybe 2011. And I was just like, how do I still have these things?
But then there's a part of you that's like, you can't get this. What if you need it? It might serve a purpose. I have just bags and bags and bags of screeners going back so far. And it's ridiculous.
It's a lot. But enough about how we're spending our time. Who are you talking to this week?
Actress Amanda Seyfried. She just got an Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actress for her role in Mank. Of course, this is the movie directed by David Fincher that's about the story of writer Herman Mankiewicz and how he came to write the initial drafts of what would become Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. And Amanda plays Marion Davies, the actress and girlfriend of the publisher William Randolph Hearst. It's really an exciting performance from her. She's one of those people that, like, you know her, but I think it's easy to take her for granted and sort of underestimate her. And in a lot of ways, that's similar, I think, to Marion Davies. And so I think she felt a real affinity for that part and really made the most of it.
It's such a tightrope to play somebody like her. And that was one of my fears in the beginning of this whole thing. Was like, am I going to fit into the 30s? Am I too contemporary as an actor? Do I move my face too much? Like people have said, I'm very animated. Does that distract or whatever? And all the things that make me me can serve me well if utilized correctly. And I don't even know what part of me I use at this point. Like, I shed most of me for this role.
It's so interesting that she's thinking of it in those terms, like whether she would be believable as a person in the 30s. But clearly, Academy voters thought so. And Mark, this ended up being Amanda's favorite acting experience to date, right?
I mean, that's what she says. And I think you can see even just in, you know, the enthusiasm that she still has in promoting the movie and talking about the movie, it obviously is something that really does mean a lot to her.
Well, we'll be hearing the reasons why in just a couple of minutes, but first, a quick break.
The New York Times calls The Boys more relevant than ever, and CNN dubs it one of TV's most daring shows. Coming April 15th, it's The Boys, the official podcast. I'm your host, Tim Cash. Join me for exclusive behind-the-scenes interviews with the creative minds behind this groundbreaking TV series. Hear from show creator Eric Kripke and executive producers Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg on how they brought the beloved comic series to the screen. And kick back with the cast and crew to find out what went into making some of your favorite scenes. These are the never-before-heard stories behind The Boys. From high-speed boat chases to Lucy the Whale to Easter eggs hidden in plain sight, we're dishing out all of the gory details. Don't miss The Boys, the official podcast. New episodes drop every Thursday, so listen now wherever you get your podcasts. And check out seasons 1 and 2 of The Boys on Prime Video.
Mark's conversation with Amanda Seyfried about Mank is up next. But first, let's hear from our columnist, Glenn Whipp, who's got his regular awards minute.
I want to talk about the Best Actress Oscar race, because I have no idea who's going to win this Oscar, and that is spectacular. That uncertainty gives me a reason to tune into the show, kind of like what I was talking about last week, where Steven Soderbergh was promising a moment in the Oscars that was going to make my knees buckle. What is that going to be? I don't know. Who's going to win the Best Actress Oscar? I don't know. Reason to tune in. I mean, for a long time, Carey Mulligan was considered the favorite to win. Her movie Promising Young Woman was getting a lot of buzz. her performance as this woman seeking revenge against toxic masculinity. But then she really hasn't won that much. And Viola Davis won the SAG Award for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And you think, okay, well, she's going to win the Oscar. But then she doesn't really have that much screen time, even though she's the title character. Unlike, say, Andra Day, who does a remarkable job of channeling Billie Holiday in The United States versus Billie Holiday. So she's great in that movie, except the movie has been getting pretty mixed reviews. So maybe a movie that's getting great reviews like Nomadland, which stars Frances McDormand. Maybe McDormand will win the Oscar, except she's won two Oscars, and she won her second one just a couple of years ago for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. So, I mean, you can see every nominee here has a reason why they might win and why they may not win. And it's kind of like, who knows? Except, I mean, the only person I'd be surprised by is Vanessa Kirby, who's remarkable in Pieces of a Woman, but she's the long shot in the category. I'm leaning toward Viola Davis, but who knows? I mean, that moment when Joaquin Phoenix, right before he opens the envelope to read the name of this year's winner, that's going to be one of the highlights of this year's Oscars.
You know, as much as people are predicting that this is going to be a low-rated Oscar show, people haven't really seen a lot of these movies. It's funny that this in some ways is actually the most exciting Oscar season of the last few years in that, as Glenn said, so many of the categories are so up in the air and there actually is going to be a lot of like tension and uncertainty going into the actual show. It's funny that like the year no one's watching might be the most exciting, you know, Oscar year in I don't know how long.
I, for one, am looking forward to it. So there's still like maybe three or four films I'm trying to squeeze in before the telecast. So we'll see how it goes. But for now, let's get to your conversation with Amanda.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, you have just been tirelessly promoting this movie. And I've heard you say that like you never get tired of talking about it. And I kind of want to know why that is. What is it about this movie, this character that you really enjoy talking about?
Well, you know, as an actor, the amount of times you get to play a real person is pretty slim, sometimes to none. This is only my second time. When you walk in someone else's shoes, someone who was real, who existed, who has their own legacy, you want to protect it and you want to preserve it. And you kind of fall in love with them in order to play the part, the way in which the story needs you to, but also in terms of their legacy that they might benefit their legacy, you want to give it all you got. And so I think I just feel really close to her. I really respect her. I really enjoyed getting to know her. And I love talking about my journey with her and my journey with David Fincher. And this whole experience it's really the greatest one that I've had as an actor in my career, because I'm working with such a master, and because this story was so close to his heart because his father wrote it, and because Marion Davies really existed and had this whole dimension that people might not have known about. And, you know, because we're telling a story that happened and that is important in a lot of ways. And yeah, I'll be sad when it's over. It is the longest campaign. That's what it ends up being, right? It's a campaign.
Has the recognition for the role, I mean, you got your first Oscar nomination. Has that been meaningful to you? I mean, especially knowing that this is something you really have connected to?
Yeah, it means the second greatest honor for an actor is to get an Oscar nomination. For me, it's everything. I don't need the Oscar. I didn't need the nom, but I certainly, you know, wanted it. That respect from your peers, that level of recognition is incredible, you know. And you work hard for it without knowing that you're really, that's the goal. I mean, the goal is to work, right? There's another goal there, a parallel goal. And now that I've hit that, it's so meaningful. I just keep thinking my lucky stars that David Fincher let me play the part.
I know, I don't quite know how to put this except simply to say, in a lot of the response to you in the movie, there's this aspect of surprise, people being sort of surprised by your performance. Does that feel in any way like a backhanded compliment? That, I mean, you've been really good in a lot of movies for a long time now. Why do you think this performance has clicked for so many people?
I think it could sound backhanded if I took it that way. If I wanted to take it that way, you could shape it into anything. But I think when people use the word revelatory a lot, I'm like, you know, I've been working a long time, and I've definitely dabbled in every genre possible. And I'm very deliberate with my choices when I'm able to make choices, not when things are just thrown to me like this. But because this wasn't a choice, this was handed to me on a silver platter, and I had to take it. When I get to make choices, when things are up to me, it's very deliberate that I hide in the role as much as possible. But I've also been in a lot of those not in terms of my perspective, but in the perspective, like an industry perspective, that less prestigious equals, for some reason, to a lot of people, like studios and stuff, equals like international hits and musicals and comedies. And I don't know why, comedies are not favored when it comes to campaign season and stuff like that, like for the most part. And I always found that interesting, and I don't know how to change that, but that's where I really hit my mark and hit my stride in my career. You know, Mamma Mia and Mean Girls and things that are not so, I hate saying it, like artsy, and but that do require the same level, the same challenge, maybe not the same type of challenge, but they carry the same weight in a lot of ways. Long story short, that's how I saw that revelatory, quote unquote, revelatory narrative. And that's okay, because I'm getting recognized anyway. I'm getting recognized for an actual performance as opposed to being a part of an ensemble. Like Les Mis was recognized in this zone, and in some ways my performance was, and everything has a different scope. Everything has a different weight to it, depending on who you talk to. And it's fine. I mean, everything that's coming from this is just positive. So bring it on.
And now, how did you come to have such a connection to Marion Davies? Like, what was it about her that sort of touched you?
The first thing about her, which is, it's what happens with every character, really. You find the things that connect you to them. You find the things that, if you were going out for coffee, were the things that you probably talk about first, or the things that you would try to relate to. And I found it really interesting that she came from a similar background as I did, and, lower middle class, brought up in a big family, and they didn't have much, and she wanted to be an artist, and she was a dancer, and we probably had similar attitudes to our careers and what success meant to us. And I think doing things we love, is that's the marker of success for us. And so I think she also found herself to be in this crazy world, this glamorous world, when she was plucked from the Ziegfeld Follies to, living with Hearst at a very young age and being courted by him. And I think I also found myself in this strange new Hollywood world when I was very young. That was the thing that I related to most. And I thought it was really amazing how she had such a sense of humor about it and no shame. And she's allergic to being fraudulent in any way. And I fell in love with that. She's a sister in a lot of ways. And it was a joy to feel like I actually really understood someone who existed in the 30s and had a very different life, but in some ways and in other ways, very similar.
And for people who aren't familiar with Marion Davies, especially her film work, like, were there any that you really liked or that you feel like would be a good sort of like introduction for people to Marion Davies?
Okay, so I always get these confused too. I'm gonna say something that maybe isn't super nice, but a lot of the movies kind of blend into each other.
Well, there are a lot of movies.
But I will say there's this one scene, and I've talked about this before, but I found her range to be extraordinary. And I think that surprises people. I really do. For people that haven't studied Marion Davies, she wasn't just a comedian, although she was incredibly effervescent and vibrant and alive. I think it was Blondie at the Follies, of the Follies. She's like trying to get into the elevator, and she's so physical and so thoughtful and so uncertain as to how she's going to play this with this guy. And it is wacky and at the same time very grounded. And playing that like madcap character, but having this sense of grounding and this sense of reality is, I don't think it's as common as it is today. And I think she was onto something. And I think that what she was doing was different than everybody else. And not to say that she was living in a different movie. Like she was just, you could reach her better. I love that. And I really hope I can do that for people too. And yeah, my appreciation for her it runs pretty deep, but that was the first time I was like, God, I can't stop watching her. I can't.
Well, one of the things I like so much in your performance is that you have this kind of like screwball energy, but then there's also this very natural and very emotional element to the character as well. And sometimes those things are existing in the same scene. Like there's a scene that's set at San Simeon where you're sort of showing Mank around the zoo there. And it's both like emotional and it's got this kind of edge to it. Where did that kind of come from? Did that just feel to you like what Davies would have been like?
It was so layered in terms of preparation and the collaboration with David and Gary. It was layer upon layer upon layer. And when you do things over and over again, when the repetition is high, you find more things and then some things become buried because you're just layering your performance because that's what happens naturally. And this is why I love the fact that we had all the time in the world to do it as many times as we needed to, because these are not the kind of performances that you're going to find in every movie. And that there was a lot going on for them. And I had a finite amount of time to lay the groundwork for who Marion was and what she meant to Mank at that time. And so it was just really important for people to understand what was happening for her and what that did to him. And when you talk about the feeling like there was like a, like I was grounded in some ways, but also just she could float away, you know, especially because she's drunk. Like it wasn't the easiest thing to capture, but the most important thing for me as an actor is to make things feel as real as possible in an unreal environment. And that's helped by, you know, working with Oscar nominated production designers and costume designers and DP, you know, like you're working with the best of the best and they're helping you capture this very authentic feeling world. So that also helps, but it's not that easy. It was a mountain that I was very glad to have been able to climb. It's such a tightrope to play somebody like her. And that was one of my fears in the beginning of this whole thing. Was like, am I going to fit into the 30s? Am I too contemporary as an actor? Do I move my face too much? Like people have said, I'm very animated. Does that distract or whatever? And all the things that make me can serve me well if utilized correctly. And I don't even know what part of me I used at this point. Like I shed most of me for this role. And luckily, I get to do that in my next role too. I get to play somebody real again. And so it has an impact when you play somebody who really existed.
And that's Gary Oldman we're talking about, who plays writer Herman Mankiewicz in Mank. I get such a kick out of in the movie. It's in that scene we're talking about, actually, when you say on nerds. Like there's something about it that's just like the funniest thing. And I feel like I could listen to you say on nerds like sort of endlessly.
Really? Thanks. It was David who said it over and over. David Fincher loves that word. I mean, I think I heard him say it like 16 times before I finally uttered it because I was so afraid that it was going to come out unnaturally. Like, you know, I'm so far from being a nerds girl. You know, that accent is just not me. I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
The New York Times calls The Boys more relevant than ever, and CNN dubs it one of TV's most daring shows. Coming April 15th, it's The Boys, the official podcast. I'm your host, Tim Cash. Join me for exclusive behind-the-scenes interviews with the creative minds behind this groundbreaking TV series. Hear from show creator Eric Kripke and executive producers Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg on how they brought the beloved comic series to the screen. And kick back with the cast and crew to find out what went into making some of your favorite scenes. These are the never-before-heard stories behind The Boys. From high-speed boat chases to Lucy the Whale to Easter eggs hidden in plain sight, we're dishing out all of the gory details. Don't miss The Boys, the official podcast. New episodes drop every Thursday, so listen now wherever you get your podcasts. And check out seasons 1 and 2 of The Boys on Prime Video.
And now tell me more about working with David Fincher. I mean, he's a filmmaker who sort of like has a sort of a mystique around him. For you, someone meeting him, I don't know how intimidated you are by that, how much that stuff kind of gets in your head when you're getting started. What was it like for you just meeting him?
I was so intimidated. I was really scared. And I had that day. My meeting was at 10 p.m. I think I was in New York. I was working all day and I was using the time because we didn't have lunch. We were doing French hours. So I was using that time to read the script between scenes. It was a really heavy movie too. So the whole thing was scary because I'm like, am I going to be able to finish the script in time? Like, I'm a really slow reader. And what am I going to talk about? Is he going to think I'm an idiot? You know, who thinks that they're similar to David Fincher? I don't know anybody who, you know, wouldn't be scared to talk to him about this passion project. And I certainly didn't have the part when I spoke to him. I mean, maybe I did, but I didn't know that. And oh gosh, it was just, also it was really intimidating because he spoke for the first half hour and I had a hard time expressing anything like what I felt and that I agreed with him. And I wanted him to know that I wasn't just a mute. But I also wanted to listen to everything he said because everything he said is so valuable and comes from such a real place. So I hate those first time things. I would never want to do it again. But then, and I'm sure you've talked to many people that have worked with him and like they all probably say similar things that once the first meeting happens, you kind of, it's very warm. You become comfortable very quickly with him because he treats you like a peer as opposed to an employee, and he doesn't hire people he doesn't respect. And that becomes very evident and it feels incredible. Puts you at ease.
I know I have heard David affectionately refer to you as a kook. And I'm wondering if like, did he encourage you to sort of bring your whole self to this part? That those elements of you that are maybe a little kooky or idiosyncratic, that's the stuff that we're all responding to in Marion Davies.
That's fair to say. It's fair to say that he absolutely celebrates who each person is and what they bring to the table. I think he knows what he's signing up for when he meets you. And I think, yeah, that's really sweet because, I've never felt like he was trying to mute something that was real that flows from my veins. Like, you know, you can't stop it in some ways, but I think it was perfectly suited for Marion Davies anyway. You know, I think if I was playing a different character and it didn't work, maybe things would be a little bit different. And I'm capable of that, but I think it definitely, Marion and I are similar in that way that we like to have fun in every experience, if possible. We don't take ourselves very seriously. And Gary doesn't either. So that was very helpful too. The relationship that Meg and Marion have is very similar to the relationship that I had with Gary, because I've known him for 10 years and we work really well together and we work very similarly. And I never felt like David ever tried to get rid of any of that, which is nice. Yeah, he's a perfect director to work with.
I know, Amanda, especially knowing that the screenplay for Mank was written by David Fincher's late father. Did that make this more emotional somehow? Did it feel like it was more personal to David? And do you think that impacted the working atmosphere, the way all of you were approaching the project?
I have a hard time believing that if this hadn't been written by his dad, that he would have been any different, that his process would have been any less important. And he doesn't do things by accident. He doesn't do anything by accident, which is why it's so great, because you can trust every decision he makes. And you know that he's laid all the groundwork before you joined, and you can just do your job. I think, you know, if he was feeling it much more than any other movie, I mean, I imagine he was, because he's had this for so long. He's wanted to do it for so long. That made me a little anxious, because I was like, God, this is it. This is his heart is attached to this more so than anything. Of course it is. How could it not be? So that was a responsibility. I didn't want to let his dad down. And so I think that was just something that we were all conscious of, but it didn't feel like, you know, we were all going to die if it didn't work out. He was as measured as somebody can be from my perspective. I don't know if he was breaking down on the inside. If he was, I was completely unaware.
And then I want to be sure to ask you about the costumes that you wear in the movie. I mean, some of them are these incredibly glamorous sort of, you know, old Hollywood style, you know, gowns. And then there's a costume party scene, and you're wearing this sort of majorette costume with like what might be the greatest hat I've ever seen. Like when you're performing, like I hate to put it in this way, but how much are the costumes doing the work? Like when you put on those costumes, do they really just help you sort of get where you need to be?
They did more work than I've ever experienced. And I have no problem giving props to what Trish Somerville and her team did for me to get to Marion. I mean, I was playing someone whose clothes were tailored to her. She was wearing couture everything, and so was I. So that was exciting. And that costume that you're talking about, the majorette costume, what? That's real. She built that to look like the costume, and it's so close to it, like scarily close to it. And the hat didn't weigh a thing. It was incredible because, you know, if you're wearing a heavy hat and you can't move your head, how are you supposed to be comfortable and how are you supposed to act? Like, I want to be unencumbered by what I'm wearing, but I want it to feel like it's changing the way I walk and talk and feel. And it does. Like that dress, that metallic mercury dress, I've been calling the mercury dress because that's what it looked like in real life. It just was not too tight, but it fit me like a glove. And I walked differently, and I saw shade, you know, and it's so interesting when you're trying to play drunk, but, you know, curious and also worried. And you're trying to play all these things like we talked about earlier, like such a layered performance, and you have all these technical things to do, and none of it matters because it's all kind of made for you. And, you know, everything helps make you forget where you really are. Because it was 40 degrees and I was barefoot. Okay. And you can't feel that at all. Sorry, I guess that's just to everybody's hard work. I don't know if I'll ever get to wear costumes like that again. It was just so nice. It's so nice to feel like they're wearing you in a way that you need to be worn. I've never understood the Daniel Day-Lewis shoe thing until this experience. Listen, everything that happens from Mank on is going to be, has shifted a little bit in the right direction, in the direction that I want it to go.
What is the Daniel Day-Lewis shoe thing for you?
Well, I'm not sure when it was said, but Daniel Day-Lewis said at some point that, you know, it's all about the shoes. The shoes are the most important piece of the character, something like that. I'm shredding that answer.
Well, you were talking about the costumes, like you were surprised by how much the costumes came to mean to you as you were shooting Mank. So I guess you found your shoes, basically.
I found my shoe. I found Daniel Day-Lewis's shoe connection to be true, finally. And I'm going to Google that, but Daniel Day-Lewis really needs his shoes to be right. And I get it now.
But now I can't wait to see like how into black turtlenecks you get. Like with Elizabeth Holmes, like the black turtleneck is going to be super specific and really important.
Yeah, I'm so fascinated by how that's going to play out. But she had a very specific posture. Very specific.
Yeah, well, I remember the Alex Gibney documentary from like a year or so ago, and I interviewed him for that. So I at least know his film and its depiction of Elizabeth. But the thing I think would be so challenging is that the fact that like there's like her sort of fake voice and her real voice, and like there are layers to her that are probably a real challenge.
And it does start. It doesn't just, you see a few different ages. You see a range and, oh, there's so much. Whew, it's going to be a crazy year.
And I have to ask, you became pregnant during the course of shooting Mank, and that led to the practical concerns of having your costumes altered. But I'm also wondering, did that impact your performance at all? Emotionally, did you come to approach any of the scenes differently?
Yeah, it's so bizarre, actually. I haven't thought about it in a while. It's fucking weird. I will say, in terms of the costumes, I was bloated from the day I conceived, for whatever reason. And I'm small, very slight. So I went to Trish because we were doing a costume check because it had been 2 weeks since I'd worn any of the clothes, a month since I'd worn any of the clothes because we had a Christmas break. And then I had a couple weeks break in filming. And I was like, I'm not supposed to tell anybody because, you're not supposed to tell people until 8, 10, 12 weeks. And I'm like, I'm totally pregnant and you're going to be able to tell. And I can't wear any of these things. it's going to change what you do. I am so sorry. And she was like, yeah, that's fine. It was no big deal for her. She's been through it before. Apparently people get pregnant on Fincher sets, as I think as the fourth person. At the time, it didn't affect me emotionally at all. Playing Marion, it wasn't a big deal. It was more just about the physical limitations that happen for me and a lot of people when they're pregnant. It was just being so unable to eat. The entire week we shot the last scene, the silent movie scene, as I like to refer to it, when I'm just in the majorette costume, I was just very ill. I thought it was going to be easy. I was like, David, I don't have any lines. So, I'm just going to be over my trailer. She's like, I don't think so. This is going to be on you. And I was like, yeah, but I don't have any lines. So whatever. I have 5 different cups of liquids underneath because I couldn't eat anything. Except cream cheese, which is funny. God. And it's so cool, though, because my son's in the movie. Sorry, I have to say, I was pregnant for Paul Schrader in a very good movie, I thought, First Reformed. And I'm pregnant for David Fincher in Mank. And it's a good story for my kids because they both got to be, they were in their first movies, in utero. And that's so special.
That's fantastic.
Oh, actually, what did change? Okay, so we reshot the scene at the San Simeon when I'm on the pyre smoking cigarette. The first incarnation of it, Hearst was on a horse. I was tied up. In fact, that was a scene where my sister gave birth. And I was so upset that I couldn't be there. So I kept checking my phone. They had to untie me a bajillion times. But that scene was completely reshot. And it was the last scene that we shot. And February 21st was our last shooting day. And then the world shut down. So thank God. Because I'm pregnant and because, there was so much smoke in the first time we shot that scene and it was back in October, November, at this point I'm pregnant. I don't want this. The smoke was freaking me out because it was a lot. It was real movie smoke that they did back in the 30s. That's wafting this cult, whatever. I forget what it was. Good cough thinking about it. And, and so we weren't going to do that. We were just going to use, fake smoke. I was probably 10 weeks at that point and I was definitely looked pregnant. I wore this shawl that changed everything for me. It there's something about holding the cigarette and wearing the shawl that my body language was, I felt like I was so comfortable with that scene anyway. And I got to wear that and I'm not giving myself complete credit for that, but I am saying that sometimes things happen and yeah.
And now you mentioned that you feel like you've turned a corner with your performance in Mank. Do you feel like you've already seen that change? Do you think you're getting offered things now that you might not have been, a year ago? Has Mank already sort of done you a service?
Yes, it's night and day. I was lucky before Mank. I got a lot of great offers and I was just going along singing my song. And then David Fincher and that just changes everything, When even winning the trades, when it's announced that you're going to be working with David Fincher, people are like, huh, that's just what happens. And I give him all the credit. And myself, of course, I'm proud of my performance. If I didn't have that performance, it wouldn't be like this. But yeah, it would have been someone else playing Elizabeth Holmes. There would have been a couple people above me on the list. that's just the business. That's how it's done. But I feel like people respect me as an actor. They always have. The people that respect me now have always respected me. For the business side of things, I'm further up on the list again, which is great. But further than I have ever been, maybe. And like this opportunity to play Elizabeth Holmes is, it's surreal. And I am going to eat it up. Like, it's my favorite thing is playing people that are real. I love imitating. And I'm not, and it's never about a full-on imitation. It's not what it's about. It's about finding the essence and creating something that is close enough without being too distracting. I'm so far down that rabbit hole. It's so fun, but it's like, I'm a little, I gotta give myself a break a little bit because it's addictive for a lot of actors. I know it's addictive. You can just stay, it's like 3 a.m. and you're still watching like footage. I didn't have that with Marion. So I'm like, really, it's really exciting.
I want to be sure to ask you about the movie Jennifer's Body, which you were in, you know, a few years ago now. And when it came out, it was not well-received critically. It didn't do that great at the box office. But just over the past couple years, it has seen this total revival. Like, its critical reputation has changed. It sort of has found this new fandom that it seems like it never had before. And what is that like for you to see a movie that I'm sure you've always been proud of, but that not a lot of other people talked about, to see it kind of revived in this way?
It's incredible. It's like having a cult following in something means that it's found its place in film history, you know, and like this kind of genre, and it's special. I mean, how weird, like so many years later that we can go and discuss something that was really special to us. It's just, it's great. It should be celebrated. It was a fantastic movie written by Diablo Cody and directed by Karin Kusama. Like that was a powerful duo. And I think Megan and I think we both feel really proud of it. There's nothing like it. Just like Mean Girls, there's nothing like it. And it's nice to be celebrated because box office, at the end of the day, it matters for a moment in time. And then what happens to it is all based on how good it is and how special it is. And so it's getting its due, which is great. It was so fun. Ugh.
And then just the last thing I want to ask you is over the past year, as everyone's been, you know, mostly at home, people have been watching a lot of things. And I'm wondering for you, is there anything that you've seen over the past year that really spoke to you that you'd want to like recommend other people to watch?
Well, there's this show called Offspring. It's a TV show. I want to say, because I'm not Australian, I want to say, and I'm, it's and Nurse Jackie too. I mean, I'm talking about when it comes to acting. As an actor, not just an audience member, but as an actor, I cannot believe I did not discover Nurse Jackie. And these are all shows, like, who cares? TV, movies, what's the difference anymore? You know, I'm about to do an 8-episode movie. That's what it is to me. Offspring is like, I want to say it was like Grey's Anatomy, like the way Grey's Anatomy hit here. There's 7 seasons. The lead, his name's Asher Keddie, and she is so special. She is a wonderful actor. I mean, I want to watch her do everything. I didn't discover her. I mean, she's like Australia's sweetheart, but I don't know the Australian culture. I've never been there. I know I have a lot of Australian friends, but I didn't know about the show until it was on Netflix. Thank you, Netflix. I recommend that to everybody. It's not everybody's cup of tea, but I was just thrown when I saw that. I'm not quite finished. I'm the end of season 6, but I have kids. And then Nurse Jackie, I mean, Jesus, Nurse Jackie, they're getting like the best New York theater actors that I'm hoping that's the cast that is carved out around Naveen Andrews and I were doing the Elizabeth Holmes project. And I'm hoping New York theater actors, there's nothing better. There's nothing better. Maybe London theater actors as well. But it's just, that's Nurse Jackie is fucking incredible. Incredible. So many seasons. God, Edie Falco is just, yeah, fucking powerful women. These powerful women doing extraordinary work, making you feel like you're there. I want to do that. I want to do that for people.
Well, I haven't seen Offspring, so now I'm excited to go check it out.
You might hate it. My best friend hated it. She was like, I cannot watch another episode. And I'm like, sure, okay, fine. We have different tastes. It's hilarious. It's hilarious. And I'm She's, I'm sure something she's done has rubbed off on me. I just don't know. Yeah. I don't know how that's going to fit into my psyche as an actor, but it's going to find its way because she's extraordinary.
Well, thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with us today.
I'm long-winded. Sorry.
No, not at all. My gosh. Amanda Seyfried, thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Mark, I hadn't known about the Daniel Day-Lewis shoe thing. So then I started Googling during the conversation. And apparently in the mid-1990s, he took a 5-year break from making movies. And he traveled to Florence and learned how to be a shoe cobbler. Did you know about this?
I mean, that's a pretty big part of his mystique at this point. I mean, he also, when he was shooting the movie The Last of the Mohicans, he made his own canoe. And so he likes to do those sort of things. I think he likes kind of tactile, hands-on things. But what Amanda was saying was basically you really have to live in the shoes of a character to kind of really understand who they are. And it was interesting to hear, her sort of extrapolate that idea.
No, yeah. No, it just led me on this journey through Google, just typing Daniel Day-Lewis in shoes.
Yeah,
and then I discovered this thing that I hadn't known. I mean, I've known other things about him, but not that. But I like how enthusiastic she is about the idea of playing real people. And I'm sort of surprised that this is only her second one. And, as we all know now, the next one will be playing Elizabeth Holmes. And I loved hearing how excited she was about digging into that.
Yeah, it's funny since usually actors are a little tight-lipped about their next thing that they're doing. So it was sort of really surprising and fun to hear her so excited, while in process, to want to talk about it.
Well, before we wrap, Mark, what have you been watching?
Well, wait, I want to go back to what we were talking about last week when we started talking about the show The Nanny.
Yes.
Because I want to know if you're still watching The Nanny, because it is 6 seasons of that show. And this is when shows were more than 20 shows in a season. And it just feels like the storytelling of it feels so different than what a show would be now. And just the length of it. It's funny. I looked, season 6, the last season, there's 2 parts, the finale part 1 and the finale part 2. And then there are 6 more episodes after the 2-part finale episode.
Maybe that was a summer run.
Have you stuck with The Nanny, or have you found that there's just too much Nanny and it's been petering out for you?
Mark, there's never too much Nanny, first of all. Second of all, the way I watch things that I've seen before and have loved before, because there was a time where I was watching it religiously, especially when my grandma would come visit, because I Love Lucy, it was a show that she could laugh at even if she didn't speak the language. So we would watch it a lot together. But with The Nanny, when I'm watching older shows, I tend to have them on in the background as I work, because it feels like conversations are happening and I already know somewhat what the episode's about. It just feels like I have friends over, or I'm in the office and hearing my coworkers talk in a way. It's there for me. I'm not really fully paying attention all the time, but it's nice to have it there. And so basically, yes, I'm still sticking with The Nanny.
Because I just keep thinking about the way storytelling on a show like that is just so different. And I keep wondering, if there was a contemporary reboot of The Nanny, what would sort of the dark anti-heroine version of The Nanny be,
Well, that's a good question. Maybe we can think of one. It could be our next project. We can make a podcast version of The Nanny.
But then a podcast version of The Nanny, you'd get no outfits.
That's true. Well, we could record it. They do that thing now where they record the podcasts. We'll do that. Maybe we'll get your tracksuit out, because I still need to see it. but, something I've been watching is This Is a Robbery, the world's biggest art heist on Netflix. Have you heard of this?
No.
It's this 4-part true crime series, but there's no murder. There's no death. It's about the 1990 robbery at the Gardner Museum in Boston. And it was the world's biggest art heist. 13 pieces of art were stolen. And the case remains unsolved. I still have 1.5 episodes to go. I recommend it. If you like your true crime without death. It's a good one. Are you watching anything other than The Nanny?
Well, I want to be sure to mention a movie that came out recently. It's called Shiva Baby, and it was written and directed by 25-year-old Emma Seligman. And it's this sort of like high anxiety comedy that's about a young woman. She's just finishing college. She's not really sure what she wants to do as like the next step in her life. Sort of a kind of a little extra spending money. She's been sugaring, like she's been a sugar baby to a man. And then she kind of ends up having to go with her parents to a Shiva, you know, to a wake. And they're at the Shiva, she both runs into her sugar daddy, who she did not expect to meet, and her own ex-girlfriend. And so it just becomes like all the separate strands of her life sort of like coalesce in this one very small, very cramped house. And it's sort of like a young female bisexual version of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And it's just a very fun, like high anxiety comedy. And I really enjoyed it, and I'd really recommend it for anybody.
Well, that's all I got was anxiety. I would have left that house immediately. I don't think I could have handled all of that coming together in one place. Like, no. But where can I watch that?
It's available on like video on demand and through sort of like some of the local virtual cinemas.
Okay, cool. I'll check it out. Well, Mark, you're taking the lead again next week before I take the mic for a handful of TV interviews in May. Tell us who you have.
We'll be talking to Emerald Fennell, who she wrote, directed, and produced the movie Promising Young Woman. It's gotten 5 Oscar nominations, and this is actually just the first feature film that Emerald has directed. It stars Carey Mulligan, who also got nominated, as a young woman who's like sort of seeking revenge, sort of working out her own sort of like issues in the aftermath of the death of like her best friend. And it's interesting in that there's a lot about the movie that deals with some very sort of like touchy and provocative subject matter. And yet Emerald really felt like she wasn't setting out to make a movie that was going to be controversial or provocative.
I wasn't trying to be shocking. I was trying to be honest. And I think that there are lots of people who find the honesty of this film confronting. And then there are those who, for lots of reasons, you know, don't want to, you know, watch this kind of material because it's too difficult. And to them, of course not, you know, absolutely. People can feel whatever they want about it. It's quite freeing, that.
I really love all the attention Emerald has been getting. For those that don't know, she was the EP on the second season of Killing Eve. And she played Camilla Parker Bowles in The Crown. Like, I just love this moment that she's having, and I hope it continues. And I'm really looking forward to listening to that one next week, Mark.
Yeah, it was really fun to talk to her. You know, she's written a musical with Andrew Lloyd Webber, and she also is going to be adapting a DC comic book. It was really interesting to hear her talk about working on that DC project because, like, she didn't feel as if, you know, Hollywood was like forcing her to do one thing. Like,
Mark, like, save it. Let us listen to the episode.
Okay.
The Envelope, the podcast, is hosted by me, Yvonne Villarreal, and by my colleague, Mark Olson. Our executive producer is Abby Fentress-Swanson. Our audio engineer is Mike Heflin. And special thanks to Mike for making our theme song.
If you like The Envelope, the podcast, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a 5-star review on Apple.
The Envelope is created by the journalists at the LA Times. Right now, access to facts has never been more important, and the Times is in the business of reporting them. Stay connected and subscribe because your subscription supports the production of podcasts like this one and our award-winning journalism. Visit latimes.com/supportlatimes to subscribe.
Thanks for listening, and see you next week.